Welcome to Aftersight's High Country News Program. I'm KG Greenspun, reading from the April edition. Last week we started the story, Perilous Paths. For mule deer, pronghorn, and elk, migration is a means of survival. But the routes they follow need protection, by Christine Peterson. And we'll finish it. First, I'm going to go to a map, the Greater Yellowstone's epic mammal migrations. Carter Mountain pronghorn. This herd, which winters in the plains southeast of Yellowstone National Park, summers on 10,000-foot-high mountain plateaus, perhaps the world's highest pronghorn range. Owl Creek Mountain's mule deer. The several thousand deer that trek through the Wind River Reservation face few risks because the eastern Shoshone and northern Arapaho tribes manage these lands for wildlife. Off the reservation, many of the deer have to navigate a major highway, fences, and residential areas. Sublet mule deer, the world's longest recorded mule deer migration, stretches 150 miles from Wyoming's Red Desert to the Hawback Basin. Research shows that the animals that migrate farthest often return to their winter range fatter than their stay-at-home kin and with more fawns. Sublet pronghorn. The Wyoming Game and Fish Commission is considering protections for this famous route. The animals migrate more than 100 miles from southwest Wyoming over two highway overpasses and across sprawling gas fields on their way to Grand Teton National Park. Where we left off, we were talking about easements, which help, but a map of the Red Desert Migration Corridor, arguably the most well-known and best protected in the West, shows dozens of parcels with no easements, some covering almost 5,000 acres. And while development has been prevented in some areas, such as a migration bottleneck near Fremont Lake, it hasn't stopped completely. In 2022, the Sublet County Commissioners approved rezoning 299 acres into 51 lots in the middle of the corridor. Later that year, it approved the construction of a 32,400-square-foot trauma therapy center, along with more than 130 parking spaces on the edge of the corridor. One of the commissioners reminded the crowd during the vote that the corridor designation does not apply to private land, reported Wildfile, a nonprofit news site. One development won't necessarily sever a migration route, said Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit leader Matthew Kaufman. But it could. Scientists can't predict exactly when a corridor will cease to function, when deer or pronghorn will no longer be able to squeeze through it or go around. Some days I look at it and think, man, how are we ever going to stop this juggernaut of development, said Brandon Skurlock, a Wyoming Game and Fish Wildlife Supervisor in Pinedale. But I still try to be optimistic. This herd is pretty resilient. Conservation-minded developments show promise. Say, a developer wants to subdivide 5,000 acres, and migration data shows that pronghorn or deer generally move through the east side of the property. With the cooperation of the state, landowners and developers, houses could be concentrated on the west side, allowing migration to continue. As Kip Alexander, who lives on his great-grandparents' land in the southwest Wyoming and grazes his cattle there, drove his pickup along a highway through the deer migration route in October, he shook his head as he pointed out subdivisions on former ranch land. He gestured at a sagebrush and grass-covered hill where deer hooves had carved trails into the ground. a post where biologists installed a trail camera to monitor progress. The gates he leaves open during peak migration. Not nearly as many deer pass through these days, he said, and there are even fewer pronghorn. But he added, it's hard to stand there and tell someone who owns some ground what he can do with it. In late October, after the deer run the gauntlet of private land in Sublette County, they reach the Red Desert, where they spend the winter munching old sagebrush tips and bitterbrush stems. Most of the Red Desert is managed by the Bureau of Land Management, which for the last dozen years and across three presidential administrations has been trying to update its plan for 3.6 million acres, an area roughly the size of Connecticut. The plan, which would be in effect for up to 20 years, includes the herd's entire winter range and could determine its fate. President Joe Biden's appointees inherited the standard four alternatives: status quo, don't change anything; development, heavy, encourage more oil and gas drilling, renewable energy projects and grazing; conservation, heavy, protect more land from development, leave wide buffers for migration corridors, and limit some grazing; and middle of the road, basically status quo, but with some tweaks. In August, the agency announced its choice, the conservation heavy alternative. Depending on who you asked or listened to, the decision would either conserve and protect wildlife and open space, according to the Wyoming Wilderness Association, or kill jobs in a state that was already doing more to address wildlife migration than any other state, according to Governor Gordon. Wyoming legislators called it misguided at best and illegal at worst. One even said during a town hall broadcast that it would affect more people than the Civil War, Pearl Harbor, and 9/11 combined. Public meetings with state BLM staffers held across southwest Wyoming overflowed with passionate opposition. Federal land management plans tend to be exhaustive processes, and the agency usually chooses the middle of the road alternative, said Joy Bannon, executive director of the Wyoming Wildlife Federation. The BLM's surprising choice, combined with its release of an erroneous travel management plan that suggested it planned to close thousands of miles of roads, contributed to the uproar. Even some conservation advocates questioned the decision, fearing the political repercussions. Joshua Coursey, founder, president, and CEO of the Muley Fanatic Foundation, a deer conservation nonprofit, said the plan, if adopted as is, could discourage the state from mapping or protecting additional corridors. Some local groups that had been working with the BLM on the middle of the road alternative felt undermined by the decision. If it is imposed, let's say, from the federal government, you're going to have resistance. You're going to have a certain amount of like hell, Governor Gordon told me in an interview. Plus, I don't think the science is going to be as well understood or as well developed or as locally calibrated. I think it's really going to become much more of a political football. Exactly why the BLM chose the conservation-heavy alternative is anyone's guess, and everyone has one. In an email, the BLM's National Public Affairs Office stated that the agency had considered many uses for the area, including energy and minerals development, renewables, livestock grazing, and cultural and wildlife resource protection. Preferred alternative B balances these multiple uses by increasing special management areas, adding additional protections for sensitive wildlife habitat and cultural and natural resources, while allowing continued energy development, the office wrote. A federal information request filed to better understand the decision-making process had not been filled by press time. Temple Stollinger, a UW environment and natural resources law professor who has spent decades observing public land policy making, speculated that the BLM was thinking strategically. After 4 years of negotiations among state and local officials, industry representatives, the Trump administration, and others, the plan's middle-of-the-road alternative contained fewer conservation measures than the status quo. Instead of going back to the state for yet more years of negotiations, the BLM's leadership may have chosen the conservation alternative with the expectation of compromising during the comments period and between the draft and the final version, which may be what happens. The BLM extended the normal 60-day comment period, and Gordon asked UW to facilitate a working group composed of representatives from the oil and gas industry and the ranching, conservation, hunting, and motorized recreation communities. When I asked the agency's public affairs office if BLM Director Tracy Stone Manning was surprised by the harsh public reaction to the plan, the office forwarded a written response. Our experience is that the more a public discussion goes into the details, science, and intention of a proposed plan, the more the heated rhetoric dissipates, and the better the final product will be. The BLM will likely release an updated version of the preferred alternative this spring, since a new presidential administration can only reverse federal decisions made in the previous 6 months. Observers expect the agency to push to finalize the plan by June. Deer 665 left her summer range near Wilson, Wyoming, on October 13th, headed south into the mountains and across the busy lanes of Highway 89. She picked her way through a sprawling Jackson suburb and into a nearby mountain range before rejoining the rest of the herd to wander in and out of private lands, cross more than 100 fences, and navigate two more highways on the journey south. The researchers who briefly captured her when she returned to the Red Desert found that she still had about 12% body fat, more than twice as much as some of her cousins who stayed closer to home. Taylor Lashar, a postdoctoral researcher with the University of Wyoming's Monteith Shop, pointed to scriggly lines on an ultrasound machine showing 665's insides. At the very top, this is all fat, and this line here, the wider one, is the bicep, she said. This animal is in good shape. Volunteers help with the trapping, and Dominic Wolf, the mayor of nearby Superior, stopped by. Kaufman and other researchers explained the various tests and described the effects of last winter as well as their hopes for the spring. Communicating with the public isn't officially part of the research, but Kaufman sees it as critical to migration survival. For while the future of this route is uncertain, it is much better protected than places like Carter Mountain in northern Wyoming, where thousands of pronghorn dodge Yellowstone-bound traffic on Highway 120, or the Wyoming Range, where more than half of the mule deer herd perished during last year's hard winter, and a migration route designation is, according to Wyoming Game and Fish Director Nesvik, likely a couple of years away, or northeast Wyoming, where antelope migrate back and forth to Montana through an unmapped maze of private land and energy development. And Wyoming, despite its slow progress on state-level protections, is still ahead of most others. Western states, a 2021 joint resolution by the Colorado legislature called on the state to develop migration policies and requested more data collection and information on species connectivity. California is building the world's largest wildlife crossing over 10 lanes of traffic, while New Mexico's Departments of Transportation and Game and Fish have a wildlife corridors action plan. Then there's Montana, where officials have mapped migration routes but won't reveal them publicly. They're concerned that publicizing the routes could harm the state's relationships with landowners who do not want their land identified as part of a route, or make the wildlife easier targets for hunters or people gathering shed antlers. The public perception is we can just fix this. Let's just save the Red Desert Hogback, and all we've got to do is build an overpass or have an easement or follow the Rock Springs management plan. But there's no magic wand, Sawyer said. There are so many things that have to happen that it's a never-ending task. In March, after a 3-year hiatus, the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission voted unanimously to proceed with the designation process on the famous Path of the Pronghorn, which passes through a sprawling gas field and lost almost 90% of its animals during the devastating winter of 2022-2023. The Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes are also working to conserve migration pathways on the Wind River Reservation, part of a long tradition of conservation that started when the tribes set aside almost 200,000 acres of land as a roadless area in the late 1930s, decades before the 1964 Wilderness Act. In 2023, the tribes rounded up 6,500 wild horses to improve habitat for species, including migratory deer and elk, while tribal fish and game biologists collaborate with colleagues in state wildlife agencies. Tribal governments have not formally participated in state-level corridor management. But Jason Baldus, the Eastern Shoshone tribal member and executive director of the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative, said it's about time that broader efforts to protect migration corridors made progress. Arthur Middleton, a USDA senior advisor for wildlife conservation and a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who has studied migrations around Yellowstone for more than a decade, sounded resolutely optimistic as he spoke about the USDA's Migratory Big Game Initiative and the value of sitting down at kitchen tables to talk through thorny issues. "I will get too depressed if I just decide it's us versus them," he said. "Still," he added later, "sometimes you have sleepless nights. We can't have endless energy development and unchecked subdivisions if we want to protect migratory herds," he said. "Something has to give. In some areas, it will be development. In others, it will be wildlife. Either way, it won't happen quietly. While there may be noisy resistance to policies like the new BLM plan, there's also passionate interest in migration, as demonstrated by the more than 24 million people who have watched a trail camera broadcasting one fence crossing, and by dedicated deer groupies like Julie Legg with her camera and her online audience." Standing in the living room of her home in Superior, Legg flipped through the TikTok videos on her smartphone. Heart emojis from her followers festooned the images of mule deer on the move. "I guess we could do without them," she said, "but I wouldn't want to." And this story is part of High Country News's Conservation Beyond Boundaries project, which is supported by the Band Foundation. Now, under reportage, Managing Predators from the Sky: How to Harness Drones for Conservation by Kylie Moore. In the summer of 2022, several researchers with USDA Wildlife Services held their breath as a drone pilot flew a large drone equipped with a camera toward a wolf standing in a pasture in southwestern Oregon. The team members, watching from a distance, expected the wolf to freeze or run away the minute the whirring rotors approached it. But to their disbelief, it did neither. Instead, the wolf wagged its tail, stretched out its front legs, lowered its head, and lifted its butt. a classic canine invitation to play, and precisely the opposite of the response researchers were hoping for. The project, led by Paul Wolf, the Southwest Oregon District Supervisor for Wildlife Services, was designed to find ways to use drones to scare wolves away from livestock, not give the animals a new toy. Later that night, the researchers tried again, this time outfitting the drone with a speaker that broadcast human voices. This time the wolf took off running. For the rest of the summer and fall, the field staff focused on using drones to discourage wolves from approaching cattle. In one case, using a speaker-equipped drone to halt an ongoing attack. The three wolves fled, and the wounded steer survived. We know for sure that we saved at least one animal doing this, said Dustin Wrangluck, the Predator Ecology and Behavior Project leader for Wildlife Services National Wildlife Research Center and a collaborator on the Oregon Project, an arm of the Department of Agriculture. Wildlife services kill more than a million animals each year. Predators like wolves, as well as invasive fish, birds, and mammals, in addition to researching non-lethal livestock protection measures. Wrangluck and other researchers hope drones will help keep the peace between predators and livestock. Early detection is your best means of mitigating conflict before something negative occurs, said Jared Beaver, an assistant professor and wildlife management specialist at Montana State University. Before livestock gets killed or before wildlife species gets in trouble and has to be killed as well. Drones are already used for population surveys and even health assessments of hard-to-reach species, such as orcas. This can reduce the need for going up in small aircraft, one of the riskiest parts of a wildlife biologist's job. But Beaver would like to see the technology more widely used with predators. He said that drones would likely be most effective when used with existing methods of predator deterrence, like range riders, people who accompany herds in order to deter wolves through their presence, guard dogs or strings of flapping flags called fladry. If equipped with thermal sensors, cameras, and artificial intelligence systems trained to recognize large predators, a drone could theoretically fly over a calving pasture at night and alert a sleeping rancher to possible trouble. Drones could also monitor areas where wolves or bears have been sighted, guiding range riders in their livestock monitoring efforts. Wrangluck's analysis of the drone's effects on wolves in Oregon showed that they can reduce attacks. Prior to the 2022 drone flights, a wolf killed a cow in the study area almost every other night. But when drones were used to detect wolves near cattle and then scare them away with recorded voices, wolves killed only two animals over 85 nights. While wolves are only responsible for about 1% of cattle deaths in the Rocky Mountain states, predator attacks can be costly and emotional for ranchers. Some federal and state wildlife protections permit landowners to kill wolves that are caught in the act, but by heading off conflicts before they start, drones could reduce the use of lethal control. Daniel Anderson, founding director of the nonprofit Common Ground Project, has been experimenting with drones on his family's ranch in Montana's Paradise Valley since 2017. Tucked inside Tom Minor Basin, the land is a haven for grizzlies and wolves. A licensed drone pilot, Anderson uses his drone to look out for his cows, surveying the landscape via his smartphone, which is connected to a handheld controller. If he detects a cow carcass, he can use his drone to check for nearby predators. It's a little dangerous to walk into those settings, Anderson said. Maybe we can use a drone to flush out animals, go in and do some recon to see if there's a bear on that carcass. After a neighbor was chased by a bear during a horseback ride, he asked Anderson to look for evidence of livestock predation by flying a drone into the densely wooded drainage where the incident occurred. Anderson's drone saw no sign of cow carcasses, but discovered that the sow had two cubs, a possible explanation to her defensive behavior. That's obviously helpful, Anderson said. That's a good use of the technology. He's also used a drone to monitor elk populations over the course of the year and to watch how different animals, deer, moose, sandhill cranes, respond to drones. Anecdotally, he's found they're all sensitive to the disturbance, acting startled when the drones are still hundreds of yards away. In his office at Montana State University, Beaver is modeling the kind of simplified drone that he hopes to see become commercially available to landowners, a flying robot that can be operated without the help of computer scientists, software developers, or wildlife biologists. I'm looking for those win-wins, Beaver said, from an ag standpoint, helping ranchers sleep better at night, and a win from a wildlife conservation standpoint, too. He imagines a Roomba for ranch operations that could be activated with a smartphone. But drones still face barriers to widespread implementation. We're all keenly aware of the limitations of this tool, Ranglack said. For one thing, they're expensive. Drones mounted with the thermal imaging capabilities necessary for nighttime monitoring, and with speakers like the ones tested by wildlife services, can cost $20,000 or more. Anderson purchased his own drone, a simpler model, for about half that. Federal Aviation Administration regulations also require drone pilots to pass a certification test, and operators need to keep a line of sight on drones while they're in use. The Oregon researchers were working in flat, open pastures where wolves could be easily spotted, but trees and rugged topography can obscure the view and make flight more challenging. Then there's battery life. A drone's rechargeable battery must be charged every half hour or so. In at least one instance in Oregon, a drone that detected a wolf ran low on power and had to return to base before it could scare off the animal. While a ground crew was able to reach the site and stop the attack, the cow was injured so badly that it had to be euthanized. Anderson is also concerned that flying at high elevation, especially in the summer, can overheat drone batteries. For his part, Anderson worries about the effects on wildlife. I don't fly nearly as much now just because of the impact, he said. Flying a drone, he surmises, is akin to introducing another predator, and it could drive off or stress birds and other animals he's not trying to keep away from his cattle. He also realizes that no single tool can fix everything. The number one killers of his cattle aren't wolves or bears, but rather noxious weeds like larkspur. And, at least for now, Anderson can only find those by riding through pastures himself on the back of a horse. That's the time. Thank you for joining me. You're listening to AfterSight.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.